Well, welcome, Patrick. Thank you for taking time out of your afternoon before the conference here to talk with me. We're both here for the Insights V1 meeting tomorrow and Friday here in Washington, D.C. Just starting off, you know, for the record, you know, how do you pronounce your name? I've heard it, you know, Duruso, you know, where do you put the accent?
Well, actually, if I look at it, I can't pronounce it. And when I was a lawyer, the Chief Justice of the Louisiana Supreme Court called me Patrick in open court because the name would routinely defeat anyone who looks at it. But the way I pronounce it when I'm not looking at it is Duruso. So the accent's actually on the second syllable.
So is that French originally?
Yes. It originally was D-E capital R-E-A-U-S-S-E-A-U-X, but it was shortened substantially after the family moved from France during the French Revolution.
Okay, wow. So where do you call home today?
Covington, Georgia. I live in the historical district in a Sears home that was built in about 1917.
So when you explain, you know, if your neighbor came up to you or you met someone in the street and they say, you know, what do you do? And they say, you know, I'm an investment banker. And then they say, what do you do? You know, how do you explain to you know, someone off the street what it is that you do?
Well, that's a question my wife has wrestled with a lot because people ask her, it's a small town, and people ask, well, what does your husband do? And so she's had to struggle with this question over the years. The explanation that I generally give people is that I actually work on standards that enable computers to meaningfully exchange information in the background. In other words, if we do our job right, the sort of things that I work on normally are not seen by users, but actually enable them to do tasks in their day-to-day office and workplace.
Interesting. So I'm familiar with your work that you do with OASIS and the ODFTC. You chair the Metadata TC. Also, your work associated with ANSI, with Insights, as chair of V1. Are there any other standards or standards work that you're involved with currently?
Well, actually, I'm presently the acting convener for Working Group 3, which is part of SC34. Actually, the real name is JTC1 SC34 WG3, which is a topic maps committee, and I'm also a co-editor of Parts 1 and 5 of the topic map standard.
Wow, so very busy.
Yes, quite busy.
So is this your first career working with standards?
Well, no, actually, this is probably my fourth. I actually started off with a law degree from LSU in Louisiana, which is my home state, practiced law as a trial lawyer for 10 years. Then Emory University offered me a scholarship to return to graduate school in biblical studies. So I left the practice of law, entered graduate school, and eventually fell in with an academic publisher, which is Scholars Press, and then went to work for the Society of Biblical Literature as their director of research and development. After I left the SBL, I had become deeply involved in standards, which is kind of ironic. How I got involved was that you couldn't represent cuneiform on a Commodore 128. And so I started studying SGML as a way of doing that. And therein lies the tale, as they say. I just sort of migrated from that into actually working on markup standards and eventually in ODF, primarily because biblical scholars who know seven or eight languages aren't going to learn XML in order to use it. And ODF, as an enabling technology behind the screen, enables biblical scholars to have documents that will persist in a legacy sense.
Okay, so that's interesting. You really didn't come to it from originally as a technologist or from the industry. You came to it more as a practitioner or an end user who had a practical problem to solve and then found out that somehow standards were either needed to solve it or at least were related to your desired solution.
Yes, because in the humanities, unfortunately, most scholars go off in a variety of directions, and so the same technical problems requires a lot of over and over and over again, which requires a lot of funding resources, but also consumes a lot of time, because most of what happens in technology projects in the humanities, you have to invent the infrastructure, and then you do the work. Well, if we can invent an infrastructure at the outset that works for the vast majority of projects, and then people can start from there and actually start doing, they can spool up to do productive work more quickly.
How did this lead you to ODF? Were you a member of OASIS before then, or you sort of found ODF already in OASIS when you initially got involved?
Well, I was already a member of OASIS when ODF started, because it was one of the standards groups when I was working for the Society of Biblical Literature. The humanities are such a small audience that we don't represent enough of a financial interest for any vendor to really specialize software for us. And I convinced the leadership at the SBL that the way to influence the development of software was to get in on the front end when the standards are being written, because for the most part, standards committees are not composed of users, but of people who are developing products or technology people. And so the SBL was able to bring a voice of, well, we're a real user community, and here are our needs. And so we were able to influence the development of things like ODF. In fact, the SBL was one of the original sponsoring members of OASIS to create the ODF TC.
Man, I mean, it's one of the things I've noticed about OASIS. One of the nice things about it is that there are a large number of standards that we work on, but also we have a large number of very small companies and other interests that we get involved. You know, people from academia, people from small companies, large companies. You know, there are a lot of stakeholders that come together to make these standards. Is there something particular in ODF that you think that helps solve the problem that you are running into with the Society for Biblical Literature? Is there some particular feature or capability that you were able to bring to ODF from that background?
Well, I think so, because I remember very distinctly the first organizational meeting we had where the question came up was on the issue of metadata, which is kind of ironic that now I'm the chair of the metadata subcommittee. But the question came up whether a document should be able to have more than one author. And the ODF format that was contributed to OASIS had provision for only one. Well, the number of times that you're going to see an article in an academic journal that only has one author is fairly rare. And, of course, when I pointed this out, that you needed to have multiple metadata elements as we had them in that version of ODF, the committee quickly agreed to say, well, of course, we should be able to have multiple author elements and multiple metadata elements related to the author so that we could effectively capture that sort of information. But beyond that, I mean, the problem that we really wanted to solve for the academics was that over the past, 40 or 50 years of use of computers in academics, you have these episodic projects that actually encode text in some kind of machine readable format, and every 5 or 6 years, somebody does the same text over again. And each time you do a text, for example, the Hebrew Bible, someone has to go through and proof this new encoding, and then as technology changes, someone's going to come along and do yet another encoding of it. And so there's this enormous body of scholarly literature and research that basically just goes out of date every 6 or 7 years, and we actually recreate all those tools all over again. And when you add that to the use of proprietary formats, which, you know, biblical scholars were all over the world. I mean, they used WordPerfect and Microsoft Word and any variety of other word processing packages that have proprietary formats. We don't have a way to effectively archive all that material unless we maintain the original software. So enabling scholars, at least going forward from here, to have a format that would support any number of applications that would leave you with an XML format for legacy purposes was going to, instead of letting scholarship be episodic so that you have scholarship that just sort of comes along and bumps and jumps and then fades away, you have accumulation of scholarly resources that you can then analyze in the future.
So is the hope that, you know, an encoding can be done once and then reused on following projects that might be, you know, 40 years down the road?
Yes, quite definitely, because the first encoding of the Hebrew Bible was done in Europe in the 1960s, I believe, and I've actually tried to obtain a copy of that. And despite the fact I know some of the principles in the original project, the encoding is simply not available anymore. It was on an IBM mainframe, as a matter of fact.
What would you say is, you know, work that remains to be addressed in ODF in this area that would kind of further the, you know, the mission of, you know, what needs to be done to for encode documents for the humanities and you know, assure the long-term, you know, accessibility of those documents?
I think the biggest thing that the document encodings in general are facing is the ability to robustly annotate and extend document formats using metadata, because even after we've recorded what I think most listeners would consider to be the raw data, we have the data in some kind of XML format, the remaining question is, will someone 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, have a different view of that same information? And as you know, from a standpoint of maintaining data, you don't ever want to open a data file, read write. We only want to open it up to read, because any ability to write to the file may lead to file corruption. So if we have mechanisms that allow future researchers to annotate data records that we have in ODF that are produced this year, 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, and add additional metadata to reflect their views of what this information is, what the information means, then we're able to not only preserve the legacy information, but we're able to adapt it to new uses, new features that we want to add to it, or new views that we have of the same data.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So you essentially have a fixed text, but then you could conceivably, you know, have additional layers. You could have a critical apparatus. You could have a translation. You could have commentary. You could have multiple different annotations of the text. How does this relate to the work that is going on in ODF 1.2 and the metadata committee? Are we going to see something like that, or see capabilities that could be used for such features?
I believe so. The metadata subcommittee has recently completed a proposal that enables the use of RDF-based metadata with ODF files, and it does so in such a way that it allows the linking of unconstrained RDF metadata to any ODF document.
Okay, so backing up, RDF, what is that, and why is that a good thing?
Resource Description Framework. It's a technology developed at the W3C. It's actually part of, and I hate to use the buzzword, semantic web activity. It was an early part of that. RDF basically operates on a notion that everything can be represented as triple. In RDF, you have a subject, you have a predicate, and you have an object. And in RDF, all of those can be represented by what you normally see as the http://, which in RDF lingo is called a URI. And if we, by using that mechanism, and there's a lot to know about RDF, by using that mechanism, the metadata work that's just been proposed in ODF is going to allow things, for example, like having asymmetric metadata. In other words, when your lawyer sends my lawyer a document, he can attach metadata to it that remains at his office. So we don't know what the other lawyer said about this document, and of course, vice versa. You'll be able to have metadata that incorporates other information about the document that you want to share internally, for example. It really opens up the window to no longer having a fixed, what we would call a dumb document, but now we can have a smart document. For example, one of the members of our TC is a medical researcher at Duke University. And if you can imagine having a medical intake form that is automatically annotated with metadata out of the hospital and patient records when someone's admitted to the emergency room, so that no one has to go look up this person's medical history. I mean, that's an illustration of how being able to add metadata to a document based on the mechanisms we've come up with would actually enhance without bothering the user. In other words, the person entering the data doesn't even have to be aware that this mechanism exists. it actually empowers them to do their job in a more efficient manner.
Okay, so metadata, obviously data about data, and you talked about this kind of triplet of subject, predicate, and objects. Does ODF define specifically, a set of what these objects and predicates are, or is this, an open-ended framework, or is it a little bit of both?
Well, actually, what we've done is, at least for the ODF standard, we've defined what the objects are, because the objects are ODF elements, which can either be the elements or it can be the content of those elements. We've defined, in other words, what we tried to do was define the content within an ODF document to which metadata would be attached. Now, what we didn't define were the predicates that you could attach to it or what subjects that you could represent. In other words, we wanted to make it as open-ended as possible. Because we can't anticipate all the possible uses or all the possible things that people would want to do with the metadata. For example, you may want to use metadata to automatically generate content in a document, but we don't know what content you're going to want to generate. And so if we were to put restrictions ahead of time on what they could actually do with their metadata, we would actually make it less useful. And a good illustration of this is traditional metadata. Traditional metadata in ODF 1.0, for example, you have a fixed number of fields. You have perhaps some user-defined fields, which are just open to whatever anybody wants to put in them. But at the end of the day, that's it. That's all that you get. And while that works, and it's better than not having metadata at all, while that works, it certainly doesn't have the power to allow users and user communities to create metadata mechanisms to enhance all the documents, for example, as I said, in an emergency admission room or in a legal system, for example, or in a number of other contexts. And so what we tried to do, and I think we did so successfully, was to create a mechanism that's extensible while remaining compatible with the ODF format.
Okay, so it sounds very much like what we have with XML. XML has the ability to represent anything, but by itself, it doesn't tell you how to represent anything in particular. We kind of rely on industry groups to develop their own specific schemas, and I guess with RDF, what would you call it? Their own taxonomies, I guess, on how they would layer additional metadata frameworks on top of the support that's will be an ODF 1.2. Is that a good way of looking at it?
Yes. I'll give you a concrete example. Adobe, several years ago, developed a metadata RDF-based framework to attach metadata to Adobe files. And that sort of metadata, RDF metadata, could be incorporated into an ODF document when you're using an image to which someone has attached ODF metadata, for example. So in other words, it doesn't replace. We weren't ever seeking to replace or displace anyone's existing RDF-based metadata, but we wanted to empower it to be able to be included or empower people to actually develop their own.
So Patrick, it sounds like this is going to be, a lot of additional work for the end user who has to enter all this metadata. Start off by entering the text, and then they have to go through and add the additional metadata. Is this true, or is there some way to prevent that from kind of being an additional burden on the user?
Well, it's certainly the case that in particular applications, users may be asked to enter metadata. But let me give you an example of a use case that we actually developed that sort of guided some of the work in the metadata subcommittee. We all are familiar with using search tools on the internet. And one of the problems with search tools on the internet is anytime it sees a word in a document, it's going to report that as a hit, or whatever a hit means, but it's going to give you a listing of that document in the search results. Well, one of the things that you'll be able to do with the ODF metadata is that companies, say for example you're an investment bank, and you develop a vocabulary for your documents. And so every time a user opens up to create a document using your system, this vocabulary is just automatically loaded or automatically referenced by that ODF application. Well, while the user is actually typing in all the terms in this document, unbeknownst to the user, metadata is actually being attached to all of those terms, so that then when they save the document, a search engine, when searching this document, has this vocabulary associated with it, so it can know whether or not a particular term means the same thing as some other term in another document. And we anticipate that industry groups and trade groups and organizations are going to develop their own vocabularies, so that instead of just seeing words, which computers are notoriously bad at disambiguating, the computers will actually have clues at this point. And we're, by starting off at the level of the user, the person who is in the best position to know what they really meant when they typed this particular text is actually in control of what's going to be attached to that. So, I mean, there are ways, very imaginative ways, of enabling users to not have to do the highlight, select sort of routine.
That's definitely an interesting idea. It's kind of a different definition or a different angle of looking at what power, in terms of like a power application, means to a user. Some people would say a power application is one that has 1,000 options and a menu for everything and a dialog box for everything. And someone else might say a powerful application is one that just has an on switch, or maybe doesn't need an on switch, because ultimately power's not what the software allows you to do, but what it allows you to forget.
Well, it's a user interface issue, which is not something that ODF really addresses, but we wanted to empower user interface designers to be able to take as much of the burden off the average user as possible, because from my perspective, and this is just purely my personal perspective, a powerful application is one that helps me do some predefined task that I want to do. Now, there are a lot of applications that will help you do that if you do it their way. But for my money, a powerful application is one that helps me do it the way that I want to do it.
So it's kind of, you know, customizable, personalizable. Moving from, you know, just encoding of pure data to encoding the full knowledge and experience that someone brings to the document. If at the point when you're typing in a zip code, that you know it is a zip code, or that you've told previously your word processor that I am likely to be a person who will be typing in zip codes, and the software is then able to recognize that and encode that in a way that later makes searching or processing or other things with that document easier, you know, you end up with a smarter, more agile document, you know, for further processing. You know, there's been a lot of talk recently about interoperability, you know, both among ODF editors, you know, how one ODF editor interoperates with another, but also how ODF interoperates with other markups, other markup languages like Ditto, DocBook, even other word processing markup languages like OOXML or UOF. You know, how does this all fit together, or how should this all fit together? You know, what are the strategies we should be looking at to deal with this?
Well, I think the first step with any markup format or word processing format that's obviously based on markup is to make sure that the standard for the markup enables interoperability between applications based on that markup system. For example, ODF, and because I know ODF better than any of the others, needs to be written in such a way, and I believe that it is, that an ODF application that produces a valid ODF document can be transferred to another ODF application written by an entirely different vendor and present basically the same behavior, assuming it supports the same features. I mean, you can have an ODF application that doesn't support spreadsheets. Well, it's not going to display a spreadsheet properly, but you knew that when you tried to load it. So I think that the first step, the first question about interoperability that sometimes gets obscured in discussion about interoperability is that, first of all, you have to have a standard that's definite enough to have interoperability between applications implementing that standard. That's step one. If you have standards such as DocBook or Ditto or ODF or OOXML that are defined sufficiently that you can have that level of interoperability, then we can start to discuss what does interoperability look like between well-defined formats. That may be a better way of thinking about it, is that really the interoperability question is only meaningful between well-defined markup standards. Because if a markup standard is not well-defined, that is, you can get varying results depending upon who you ask, then you know interoperability is really not even a meaningful question in that case.
Yeah, it seems there's also a, I don't know, maybe an inverse relationship between, and maybe I'm thinking of this wrong, but it seems there may be an inverse relationship between the flexibility of a markup standard and the level of interoperability, if you define interoperability as literal identity of representation or rendering. Maybe an example makes it clear. HTML does not specify line wraps, you know, unless you explicitly enter a carriage return. It leaves a lot to the discretion of the agent of the browser. That makes HTML much more applicable to many more situations, whether you're talking about a mobile phone or a TV set-top device or a traditional browser. But it also means you cannot guarantee that it's going to look identical everywhere. It also gives it great power for things like screen readers can process it. Whereas you have other markup languages that may take a very strict route of specifying in minute detail every single aspect of it, such that it could only be rendered correctly, maybe even only on a single application or at least a single context.
Well, it's true that HTML is underspecified to the point that it can be rendered on a number of platforms, but therein lies the problem. Because, for example, if you have subtables within a table and someone's using a screen reader who is needs it for audio presentation of this table, there's no information to give it a clue as to how it should actually read that information. And so while it's true that a sort of crude format like HTML does have a certain amount of general application, it's also the case that if you want more powerful applications, such as for accessibility, such as for more sophisticated data processing, then it's necessary to have more tightly constrained or defined markup. But now the other thing to realize is that normally people think of interoperability in terms of what am I going to see on the page? And actually, that's probably the wrong question to ask, because if you recall, XML at its inception was an interchange format. That is, that we can take an XML document which has a well-defined syntax by the XML standard and hopefully well-defined semantics by some standard that defines a particular markup format and meaningfully exchange it between applications on different computers. And that's an interchange problem. Now, once we solve the interchange problem, how you actually present the information, because sometimes, for example, if we're storing a large set of XML-based documents in a document store, we're not really concerned about the exact presentation of it. We're concerned about search and retrieval. There are cases where the presentation of the document is important. So, I mean, there are, but the underlying notion of XML is that we're able to exchange semantically meaningful documents in such a way as that I can determine what was meant by the original author. In other words, I can have, well, not the author, but by the original application. So to some degree, it's the interchange aspect is actually probably more important in most cases than the actual appearance of the document. Although obviously with style sheets and metadata that could do hinting, for example, for the rendition of particular aspects of a document, we can get a lot closer to having the same presentation. But I think the underlying notion of the committee is not so much the presentation, but the preservation of the original data, its original structure, and how you should interpret that so it'll be meaningful to the next user in this document chain.
Yeah, it makes me wonder whether we should, evolve the name from word processor to, idea processor, or some other thing. Because I agree with you that we're moving from a point where the word processor was the way of producing the brochure, the printed output that would be sent off to customers. And in some cases, it may still be done that way, but more and more for the higher quality output, for the greater control over visual design, people are moving to more complicated tools, Adobe Illustrator, Quark, stuff like that, publishing applications. Whereas the word processor most likely is producing output that will be read by someone else in electronic format, will essentially be treated as hypertext. Even a Word document or an email today has a lot of sometimes external as well as internal navigation, layered with metadata, and more often than not will be stored centrally on a server or distributed, via a web or some internal portal, and then will need to be indexed and found and processed. It's no longer just create a document, print it out, and hand it to someone.
Well, that's true, and I think if we can sort of diverge a little bit of history, I think we need to remember that word processors and document processing in general developed from a background of us understanding documents as being printed materials that you could print out on a page within the codex format as we know it. And I think the notion of what we mean by, quote, document is slowly evolving. But most of us, when we think about a document, we think about a letter, we think about an office memo, we think about a term paper we may have written in college. But actually, that's kind of an artifice of the way we have traditionally thought about documents. And as we slowly get computers to regain some of the abilities that we've always had with printing, and by way of example, earlier you were talking about being able to have commentaries on documents and commentaries on those commentaries, that was actually solved in the 14th and 15th century when they first started printing the rabbinic Bibles. And so computers are about to catch up with where we were with our printing capabilities of hypertexting and linking divergent documents together. And so our actual notion of documents is becoming more sophisticated in computers, which is eventually going to catch up with where we were several hundred years ago in the humanities.
So when you look at ODF, we see that ODF reuses a number of existing W3 standards, from the web, things like, using parts of SVG or using part of XForms, XSL formatting objects, etc. Is there, MathML, for another good example, is there some natural or intended relationship between document markup standards for use in word processes, etc., the traditional use of documents, and web documents or web-based pages? Is there some connection or evolution? For example, will we ever see these converge?
Well, I'm not real sure I would use the word converge. I think what's happening now is, to be honest with you, we really don't understand all the implications of the document markup standards that we already have. For example, like HTML or XHTML, or ODF or DocBook. I mean, we've used all these for years in a variety of other markup standards. And it's only by years of experience of actually applying these in real-life situations that we start to sort out what's important, what's not, what new features do we need to have. And it's not the case, I don't think, that document format standards are static. They're going to continue to evolve as users. It's sort of like if you think about the evolution of the personal computer. At first, they didn't have very many capabilities at all, and so nobody thought about doing a lot of extra things with them because its limitations were too great. But as more and more processing power becomes available, and there are people now doing molecular modeling on high-end workstations, which would not have been conceivable 20 years ago. And so as our formats offer more capabilities, as I think we're trying to do with ODF, it's actually going to drive the need to examine other formats to see what are they lacking. So it's not the case that one is they're actually going to converge, which they may eventually get closer to each other, but it's a question of evolving a deeper understanding as we realize there are more things that could be done than what we've done in the past, simply because we understand the technical requirements, we understand the markup requirements, and a variety of other factors. So it really is, it's not a fixed target. It's not like one day we're going to wake up at ODF, 3.5 or 4.0 or whatever and say, oh, we've done everything you can do with a document. I don't think that day is ever going to come. And it's not simply because I like working on standards and hope to still be doing it 15 or 20 years from now.
Now, an interesting, an analogous evolution is what you could look at with HTML. HTML 1.0, its pre-standards version did not even support images. It was really just a text format. But as it evolved, at first it was attributes deeply intertwined with the content, then with CSS style sheets, we got a separation of content and styles. Eventually we got a DOM object, we got JavaScript. These came together to give us dynamic HTML, the ability to manipulate and create documents on the fly. And then with the coming of some new modes of working with documents, we got Ajax, which led to mashups and all the fun stuff we're seeing today. And I wonder whether we might see a similar progression of documents where first get the base document standard, the static markup of the document, started initially as we did with ODF, getting a good separation of content and styles, but then move on to that into programmatic abstractions, a DOM object for a document, followed by scripting, followed by, is there some future where we can do a mashup between two documents in a dynamic way where we're taking data and metadata from multiple documents and projecting that somehow onto another document?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that's sort of the long-term view that I have, is that eventually we're going to understand documents and the objects that occur within documents and the relationships between those objects in such a way as that we will be able to view divergent XML representations, say DocBook versus ODF, for example, and it's simply a different XML expression of what is a commonly understood set of document objects and relationships between them. But that certainly is a in the future, but not the distant future. I think that's going to be over the next 2 to 4 years, because as more document formats near standardization, the need to have really robust, not just interoperability in terms of interchange, but interoperability in terms of the capabilities that we associate that are bundled with documents, it's going to become an ever increasing need that will need to be answered.
So, Patrick, you've talked a lot about metadata and the work that's going to be coming out very soon in ODF 1.2 with the output of the metadata subcommittee. If a listener wanted to delve into that a little bit deeper and learn, kind of more about metadata and the concepts there and the benefits and, the opportunities of metadata encoding in documents, what would you recommend as a good place they could look for more information?
Well, one of the places they could look for more information, at least from a very practical standpoint, would be the ODF Metadata Subcommittee website is actually going to have an examples document that doesn't go into all the gory detail, but actually has real-life examples of how people can use the metadata that we're specifying in ODF 1.2. Another good source for information about metadata would be to visit the semantic web pages at the W3C, particularly Tim Berners-Lee's Scientific American article from 2001 gives a fairly futuristic vision of what metadata can do. But the point that I would want to emphasize to people who are interested in ODF now, in metadata now, is that the use of metadata can have practical bottom line benefits now. I mean, it may come to pass someday that your computer will be able to set up a tennis match with your doctor next week or something like that. But which would be it'd be interesting. But there are a lot of business applications right now in terms of searching, in terms of handling routing business documents for approval, in terms of legal proceedings, medical records, and a variety of other places where metadata will have a payoff here, now, today. And I think, you know, that's the sort of thing, the sort of bottom line question that sometimes gets lost in the sort of airy theoretical world that I live in most of the time. But I think that's the one that I would point people to in terms of as being a motivator for businesses and consortia and industry groups to start looking hard at metadata and capabilities in formats like ODF.
Okay, and it looks like that's around all the time we have for this afternoon. I'd like to thank you, Patrick, for stopping in and agreeing to be recorded. This will be very interesting. I remember a quote I just read recently. It's one thing to strip yourself. It's another thing to be stripped. Another thing entirely to be stripped. So thank you for having your thoughts stripped here for our listeners, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Well, I appreciate it. And let me note for the record that I still have all my clothes on.